Hello, I'm Hal Stone.
And I'm Sidra Stone.
Welcome to the Mendocino series of voice dialogue tapes. In this tape, we will be telling you all about the dance of the selves in relationship.
Relationship is a subject very dear to our hearts, since we're obviously in a relationship, and an awful lot of our work and of our discoveries have come out of our relationship. It's been a remarkable teacher for the two of us.
For me, a relationship marked a real change in my life, because before I began to work on these issues with Sidra, my orientation in consciousness work was quite introverted. I saw the consciousness process as essentially a highly introverted process, and I certainly never had the idea that I could learn things on a serious level from relationship. A partner was something that you needed for a wide variety of reasons, but the last one that I could ever imagine was that it would support my own search for consciousness. So this movement represented for me a rather major shift when I began to discover that relationship itself could be a very serious teacher. I don't mean to imply that relationship replaces our introverted work. There's a place for our introverted solitary work, and there's a place for relationship work. And both together, of course, are extremely important. At this point, I feel really quite passionate about the subject because it has brought so much to me, and it has meant so much to me, that I'm excited at the idea of beginning to bring our discoveries to a wider audience and to begin to open out our thinking about the primary selves and disowned selves and bonding patterns, which have brought so much to us and are a matter of really very great excitement.
Well, as a woman, you know, relationship has always been important to me. Somehow, I've found with other women, too, it seems to be that our relationships have always motivated us to grow. There was something going wrong or there was something going right, and that would be always the starting point for a new journey. I've been kind of impressed that in fairy tales that's often happened. The fairy tales that have a woman as a heroine very frequently are started off by her falling in love and then having to move on from there. So it's been a very exciting thing for me to, with you, have relationship as a path. It was interesting, too. Remember last week when Michael Tom said to us that Krishnamurti had told him that relationship is a perfectly valid and very, very important spiritual path. I was very excited to hear that somebody of his stature has that as a view of relationship.
In beginning to look at the journey of relationship, we need to start where we always start, and that is at the primary and the disowned selves.
Excuse us, guys, but that's where we have to start again.
In our tape introducing the psychology of selves, we go into the subject, but we do want to summarize again very briefly what these ideas are about. We have to keep in mind that in the developmental process, we begin with vulnerability. The vulnerable child is the key to a great deal of what happens in relationship. We are born fundamentally vulnerable, and the primary selves are the parts of us that develop to protect that vulnerability. If we grew up vulnerable, life would be extraordinarily painful. We would not be able to make it because the planet Earth is not oriented towards the support of vulnerable children. So we have to become powerful. We have to learn ways and methods of protecting that child. The primary selves, then, are the parts of the personality that come into operation to do that. They vary enormously. In one person, they might be power selves that allow us to be aggressive, ambitious selves that allow us to make money and be successful.
In another person, they can be pleasing selves or gentle selves that make us extraordinarily lovable to everybody around us.
In another person, it would be selves that withdraw us into fantasy because life is too painful and we can't meet it on the outside and we go into fantasy. And that can be a primary self.
Mm-hmm.
So the primary selves can take many, many different forms. The problem with primary selves, it's hard to know what your primary selves are because we are identified with them.
Yeah. I am who I am. That's what my personality is.
Exactly.
So either I'm hardworking and tough and aggressive, or I'm gentle and sweet and loving, or I'm thoughtful, or I'm passionate and emotional all the time.
Right.
I wouldn't see these as primary selves. I just see them who I was, right?
Exactly. So if I criticize you, if I'm your friend, then I criticize you because you're too passionate.
Mm-hmm.
If being passionate is a primary self and I'm your friend and I criticize you because you're too passionate, you're going to say to me, that's the way I am. You're criticizing the way I am.
That's right. I wouldn't think that that was a primary self. And then in turn, I'd probably judge you and think, you know, he's always so tepid. He doesn't get passionate about anything. He's just tepid and rational and sensible all the time.
Right. So this is one of the reasons why it is that it's so difficult to take in people's reactions to us. Because our primary selves hear the reactions, and the primary selves are being criticized, and they, of course, are going to do everything they can to deflect the reactions and the criticisms that we get. On the other side of every primary self is going to be an equal and opposite energy. So if I grow up identified with power, on the other side is going to be vulnerability. If I grow up identified with being a pleaser, on the other side is going to be somebody who's fundamentally not a pleaser, somebody who's very selfish.
If I grow up being a sort of a flowing, gentle hippie, the disowned self is going to be the self-disciplined businessman.
Exactly. The rule of the psyche, the law of the psyche, number one, is that whatever it is we disown in our own life and process, that is exactly what the universe is going to bring to us. Whatever this equal and opposite energy is that we don't know about because it's been disowned, it's going to be brought to us through our children. They will live it out. We will bring in friends who carry it. Our husband or wife will carry it.
Our business partners, our business associates,
our
employees,
cats,
our cats and dogs carry
and dogs
things,
carry
or our horses.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's going to carry it.
Or our snakes. I knew a very mild guy who had a boa constrictor in his bedroom.
Right. That's a good expression of a disowned self.
Right.
So it behooves us then to become aware of these disowned selves and primary selves because they are constantly interacting with everyone around us. A relationship is not between two people, it's between 102 people.
It's between two groups of people. So we've got our primary selves interacting with the other person's primary selves on the surface, and we've got all these disowned selves kind of boiling and broiling around underneath the surface. And there are really metaphysical implications of all this. It's as though there is something within us, a force for growth and completion, that brings to us these disowned selves, these pieces of the puzzle that are missing, and they bring it to us over and over again. And when we stop fighting it and we stop fussing about it and we stop judging it and everybody else, we can stand back and see relationship really for the teacher that it is, for the spiritual teacher that it is. And it often is a humbling one, I must say.
Yes.
Haven't we noticed that?
Yeah, we've learned that. I think this idea that you just mentioned is something that's really so beautiful and so important. To think that there is in the universe an intelligence in the universe outside and in our own inner universe, that there is an intelligence, a kind of a mathematician of the universe who knows exactly what the energy is that we need to complete ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come into life and we come into a certain family structure and we develop along certain primary selves. And then, amazingly enough, this mathematician of the universe comes along and brings to us exactly the energies that we need to complete ourselves.
Right.
But we don't
right.
know that. You see, what we have is we meet somebody and they carry our disowned self, and we may love that person at first, but eventually there's a lot of stress and a lot of judgment and a lot of anger and a lot of bad feeling and a lot of pain and extraordinary suffering. And this pain and suffering go on until we can step back and appreciate the mathematics and the harmony of the whole thing, and appreciate the fact that this person in our life who's causing us so much aggravation is, in fact, our teacher. is in fact the embodiment of the energy that we need to complete ourselves.
Well, it's interesting because it's true, isn't it, that we have an infinite number of energies available to us. It's as though we have an infinite spectrum, and we work from a very limited portion of that spectrum, and each disowned self actually brings us a new piece of the spectrum. It brings us a new way of looking at things. It brings us a new set of ideas. It brings us a new way of appreciating life and everything that's going around us. So the relationships in our lives really are magical. They are magical. They're literally magical. They bring us new selves. They free us from old selves. Again, I think so many times of the fairy tales. You know, it's almost as though we're imprisoned with our primary selves. Rapunzel is in the tower of her primary self, and she's calling and singing out of her tower.
That's a wonderful idea. That's right.
Yeah, and then the prince comes, and he rescues her from that tower of her primary self. And actually, in that particular story, it's interesting because she does get thrown out of the tower, and she has to spend many years wandering in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And greeting all these disowned selves until she becomes who she was and gets back with her prince again.
Yeah. It might be interesting to the audience to talk a little bit about some of our own primary selves and disowned selves when we met.
Because, well, it's always kind of fun to do that because that's really what we're our teachers, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
We had some pretty good ones, right.
Yes, let's see. I started out being very rational, very cautious, very planned, very planful. You wouldn't believe how planful I was.
Well, I would believe it.
You would believe it.
And I appreciated it very much because it made me feel very safe.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was the opposite. I was much more the dreamer. I was the visionary. I did not do the kind of careful planning. I sort of trusted that the universe was going to take care of things.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating and wonderful to me.
Yeah.
I adored it. It made me see all the magic and the flow in the universe.
And those differences, which were very precious to us at first, they were part of what really brought us together because
right.
we were so very different that way.
We really held the other half for one another
yeah.
on a lot of them, particularly that
yeah.
area.
Later on, we'll talk about what happens when these differences turn from love to sour mash, but we'll wait for a moment on that. Another place that we were very different was in regard to money.
And that's a real common difference that people have.
That's a big one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was, in a way, it's related to the first one. I was committed to the idea that there is abundance and that I was connected to the abundance line in some way. And that if I did right in the world and I stayed connected to what God required of me, that I would be provided for. I also was a spender. I spent money not on a lot of worldly possessions, but I spent money fairly freely if I felt it was important to the service of mankind. That was my hook. I didn't need to buy expensive cars, but I made very serious sacrifices when it came to building organizations that were devoted to consciousness work and things of that kind. And I did it without heed for the consequences to my personal well-being.
Yeah, I wasn't exactly constituted that way.
Yes, I know that.
I really came in from the other side. I was very, very, very careful. And I used to talk about myself as sort of like a little German lady with a very small purse. And I opened up that purse very carefully for any kind of expenditures. And I thought very seriously about where the next dollar was coming from. It was kind of scary to me, even at the beginning, about how you felt about money.
Yeah,
terrifying,
that one,
maybe. That wasn't a delicious
yeah,
difference
no, no.
we had.
That was a difference that caused trouble from the very, very
yeah.
beginning.
We didn't exactly appreciate each other's differences on that one, did we?
No, not at all. That was a heavy one.
Yeah, then there was another difference between us. I was solution-oriented. I wasn't really into process. My idea of dealing with a problem was, you figured out the best thing to do, and you did it as quickly as you could. One of my favorite sayings used to be, just give me a solution, any solution. If it's wrong, I'll change it, but anything to get the tension over with and just get moving in some direction, any direction.
Yeah, I was exactly the opposite, and I still, to a large extent, have that as a primary self system.
Mm-hmm.
As we get older and we do a lot of work, our primary selves are, and disowned selves are not black and white anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the primary self as one God, In this approach to consciousness, you learn to worship all the gods and goddesses.
That's right.
But you can have your favorites, and the primary self represents the god or goddess that's sort of the favorite, and then the other side represents the one where you have to learn to sort of dance the minor dance. And as in Greek mythology, the gods and goddesses didn't mind if you had a favorite. What they minded is if you left them out of the system. That was very dangerous.
Right. Well, I must say the money one evened out a lot over the years.
That one, oh, yeah.
We changed places.
Yes, that one
that was a fun one to integrate.
But I really am a fundamentally process-oriented person. Mm-hmm. I have the ability to stand still and stay in tension for a long time. I don't like jumping into things where I don't have the feeling that there's some kind of organic flow. I have appreciated your way of working because a lot of times it just there isn't time to wait, and mm-hmm. you know, you can really go crazy when things have to be done. So I have in that one, I think I've sort of rested into you more.
Mm-hmm. And I've learned to trust you on that one.
Yeah,
but it's still not my natural
right,
way of being.
Yeah.
I'm still much more, I guess, an Aries that way.
Right,
I want
right.
things done.
Yeah.
The other really big difference was that I was much more personal than you were. I was very related on a personal level to people. It was very difficult for me to be impersonal and to use thinking in terms of my relationships.
Well, this is, of course, a big one. I mean, that still is a big difference between us.
Mm-hmm.
You've pulled in a lot more impersonal, and I think I've become a lot more personal. But this is one of the basic differences that you find in relationship in many, many different people, in friendships, in primary relationships. It's amazing the amount of difficulty it causes in relationship, and it certainly caused its share of difficulty in our relationship
right.
because it resulted in a very different approach to different problems that came up.
Right, because I'd be concerned about the personal relationships with people and the feeling qualities, and you would be related more, you would be more distanced.
Yes.
In a very easy and natural way.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was easy and natural. I certainly got criticized by plenty of people for being too impersonal.
Yeah, your impersonal has been famous. I mean,
it's
worldwide famous.
Right, right. And I think that even the dog on our property, Molly, appreciates my impersonal. That's
because yeah, come she's on, a, tell the Molly
well,
story.
Well, Molly's a very personal little dog who is a natural daughter. And one time we were going on a walk at a time that I was feeling very stressed. And when we are stressed, we tend to go to our primary selves. So I was being very impersonal and very much the rejecting father. I just kept getting pushed farther and farther. And the more I went into the impersonal, the more Molly was jumping and licking and biting. And she was driving me crazy. I was ready to kill her. And suddenly, after about a couple of miles, Sidra started to laugh. Hysterically, really, at what was happening. And she said, Hal, you're in a bonding pattern to Molly. And suddenly I realized that I had driven her into this pleasing, demanding, licking daughter who
mm-hmm.
was, you know. And I started to laugh. And the interesting thing is the moment I separated from that pattern and got back to myself and, you know, realized what was happening.
Back into his aware ego.
Back into my aware
really.
Ego. She left me alone and went off very, very happily. It's amazing how these things work. So the personal-impersonal is a big one, and we'll be giving more examples of that later in this tape as to how important that particular one is.
Okay, should we start thinking about a little bit about falling in love and what that does to us and our sub-personalities?
Good place, good
okay,
place.
Okay, because that's kind of, what we're talking about is not just primary or love relationships. This falling in love can be with anybody. It can be with a child, it can be with a therapist, it can be with a guru.
New friend.
It could be with a new friend who's just too wonderful for words. But when we first fall in love with somebody new, something very magical happens. There have been a lot of ways of talking about it, but one of the things that we've noticed is that the vulnerable child feels safe. The vulnerable child feels safe, feels absolutely loved, and unconditionally accepted. And when that happens, what's the natural response to that is that the primary selves can relax. They can relax, sit back, they don't have to protect anymore. And when the primary selves relax, sit back, and stop protecting, it gives us a chance to have the disowned selves start to emerge. We're more in a natural flow. We're more in an aware ego with opposites available to us, with new possibilities coming in. we're closer, as we always are in our aware ego, to our essential self and to that vulnerable child.
So the falling in love process is really a very important kind of process, because without it, it would be very, very difficult to enter into a relationship in the first place.
That's right.
Because it really is the thing that neutralizes the primary selves, and it's the thing that really builds the bridge between people.
Mm-hmm. So it allows our two vulnerable children really to get together.
Right. I mean, imagine a very rational man on one side of the river and a very intuitive, flowing woman on the other side of the river. How would they ever be able to build a bridge between them, with those kinds of differences? The falling in love process really allows that bridge to be built, allows them to, make the projections onto each other that are necessary. And what does that mean, to make projections? It's a language that I think is very important to understand. It simply means that the disowned selves of the two people get thrown across the river onto each other's laps.
And they're gleaming beautifully there. They're not looking bad. They're
right,
looking absolutely
exactly.
Delicious and marvelous. So how would this work in terms of some of the primary selves? Say I'm a very busy lady, and I'm very, very well organized, and I make use of every minute of my time. All the time. So that would be my primary self. And then I fall in love all of a sudden. And what happens? I don't have to be busy to prove I'm lovable. I don't have to accomplish a lot. My primary self can relax. And all of a sudden, I discover that I have time to do other things. To sit back, to look at the sun, to take a walk in the evening, to visit. There are all sorts of time pockets that open up that I never noticed were there before.
You might have hated talking on the telephone, and suddenly you can talk on the telephone for hours and hours without any concern that you're wasting time. The concept of wasting time doesn't exist anymore.
That's right. I don't have to be accountable for every 2 seconds of it. Well, say I've had a critic at my neck, picking on me all the time, making me feel rotten about the way I look or the way I act or what I'm getting done in the world. And I fall in love, and all of a sudden I'm perfect. I'm lovable just the way I am. The critic doesn't have to make me over to make me acceptable.
That's a wonderful
example.
And
that's a whole different way of being.
I'd forgotten about that. The critic does disappear in that falling in love process.
Sure
does.
It's
like with the neutralization of the primary selves, the critic goes out the window for a period of time.
Right. You can look in the mirror and really enjoy yourself.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Unfortunately or fortunately, as the case may be, this falling in love period doesn't last forever, and certain things begin to happen. Stress enters into a relationship.
And what happens when stress enters into a relationship is that child inside is threatened again.
And when that child is threatened, a particular thing happens to all of us, and that is we begin to revert back to the primary selves.
So they gird their loins and they come back into the foray and start fighting for us again in whatever form that they had taken in the first place. And when that happens, then the disowned selves and the other person that were so delicious to begin with suddenly turn into dreadful problems.
And here we begin to enter into the idea of bonding patterns. This term, bonding patterns, is very basic to our work, and we would like to explain what we mean as carefully as we can, because the understanding of bonding patterns is what gives us the real information retrieval system about interactions in relationship. First of all, we have to understand that bonding patterns are the basic unit of interaction between people.
And we deliberately use the term bonding patterns because that is the pattern that emerges at birth, the bonding between the mother and the child, the mother being able to give nurturance and the child being able to take it.
Bonding patterns, then, are the interactive relationship between parent-child. And as Sidra just said, initially it's the parent-child interactions with our original parents or step-parents, siblings to some extent, and these bonding patterns become recreated in our friendships and our relationships and our primary relationships. All of these different original patterns are recreated in our relationships as adults, and we have the opportunity then to solve the issues in our relationships that we were never able to solve in our original family constellation.
Right, but we mean something very special by these bonding patterns. It doesn't mean that I am bonded into Hal as a whole person. What it means is that the mother parts of me are bonded to the son parts of Hal, and the daughter parts of me are bonded to the father parts of Hal. So bonding patterns represent the interactions between subpersonalities or selves, the parental selves of one side and the child selves of another.
So let's repeat here for a moment our definition of consciousness so we can fit our thinking about bonding pattern into this. Remember that for us, consciousness exists at three levels. The awareness level gives us the ability to witness whatever is happening. The experience of the different parts of ourselves allows us to know experientially what the different parts of us are like. The ability then to utilize awareness and to take advantage of experience is done by the aware ego. The aware ego develops as we become aware of the different primary selves and the disowned selves on the other side. So in the bonding patterns that are going on, if I am in father,
and I am in daughter,
that's a bonding pattern. If I can separate from that bonding pattern and become aware of it, if my aware ego then can experience the father side of me in relationship to Sidra,
and then the son side of you in relationship to me as well,
right, then I'm in a position where I can separate from that bonding pattern. This does not mean that the bonding pattern is going to disappear, because they never disappear. It simply means that I, as an aware ego, can also exist separately from that, which means that I am able to meet Sidra as an aware ego, and I can meet her in the place of her aware ego, even though the bonding patterns are still active, still operating between us.
So what does it mean when we can actually meet in a space of an aware ego? It means that we have some choice in our interactions. We don't behave automatically. And it also means that as we make these choices in our actions, we have some access to our essential selves or the psychic fingerprint. We can take that into consideration as we're moving forward and interacting with each other.
I think it's important here, Sidra, to say a little bit more about that psychic fingerprint. We talked about it in the mapping the psyche, mm-hmm. but just to say a little bit more about that, because after all, you know, people sometimes ask, well, this aware ego, what does that mean in relationship? You know,
And the aware ego really is what enables us to express more fully who we are. It allows us to express this psychic fingerprint, this mark of who it is I am on the deepest part inside of myself, what it is about me that's different from everybody else, or what's different about you from everybody else.
Right. And most importantly, we do not judge the father-daughter nature of our relationship
or
the
mother-son
nature of our relationship. These bonding patterns are basic units of psychic interaction. They are always present. If you try to get rid of them, it's hopeless. You'll never get rid of them. So you might just as well as learn to enjoy them, become aware of them, separate from them. When they come and take over again, when you think that you've gotten something solved, the best thing you can do is just to rest back into that and find out and so forth and so on.
Because we're always learning. And it's funny because no matter how many times we say this to ourselves or to other people, the whole idea that's picked up by our perfectionists and our consciousness pushers is that there's some way that I can get out of bonding patterns and lead this totally free, clean, choice-filled life.
Right. Another thing also that I think is a very interesting idea is a lot of people try to have aware egos,
mm-hmm.
or they try to have awareness. Now, if there's anything that I can say in my long years of work as a psychotherapist and a teacher of consciousness, the more you try to have awareness, the more you try to have an aware ego, the worse it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because the act of trying changes and shifts your behavior away from what's natural.
Mm-hmm. It switches it away from
right.
who you are.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that we've really learned so beautifully from our relationship as we sink more and more into who we are. Even if it's a total difference between us and there's a tremendous amount of friction or tension, it usually brings us to the next step. It may
right.
look as though we're going in totally different directions. And if we stay honest to that and we stay aware of what's going on, it brings a new integration at a deeper level
right.
and a more complete level.
So for me, the principle is that you can't aware life. You have to live life.
Right.
If you
on.
Try to be aware before you live it, then the passion is over. So you have to live life, and then after you get knocked around in a particular situation, you try to figure out what went on.
Right, and if you do away with awareness and you just live life, you're just totally chaotic and at the mercy of every little wind that blows from wherever it blows.
Exactly. So in relationship, we have to be very, very kind to each other and kind to ourselves when it comes to these interactive processes and bonding patterns. Because as we're going to discover, an amazing amount of our time in personal relationships is spent living in these bonding patterns. And the more that you study them and learn about them, the more shocking it is to realize how much of our time is spent in them. Most bonding patterns are existing between people in a positive form. What I mean by a positive form is that they're not causing trouble. So if I'm behaving like a good father,
and I'm behaving like a pleasing, compliant, grateful daughter,
that's not causing trouble between us until something shifts. I may become aware that I'm in good father, but generally what happens to people is that the positive bonding pattern triggers to a negative bonding pattern. So I would say for 3 days I'm locked into good father. Suddenly I go into negative father, and from that place I start to attack you. And you don't know what hit you. And suddenly I'm negative father to your either frightened daughter or rebellious daughter. And we're going back and forth.
Yeah.
And we're really at it with each other. So these negative bonding patterns cause a lot of pain and suffering in people's lives. But the thing that we have to realize is that when a positive bonding pattern triggers to a negative one, it lets us discover a very important fact, and that is that we have been living in a bonding pattern.
So that would mean that you were being responsible father and I was kind of drifting into letting you take all the responsibility.
Exactly.
Or good father. And,
exactly.
And conversely, you would have turned into a more passive son and my good mother would have been running things. And we would have just drifted into it in almost an unconscious way.
Exactly. So when the thing goes sour, and we blow at each other, you see, at that particular point, suddenly we break the vessel apart that we've been living in at that particular moment, and we discover we've been living in a positive bonding pattern, and it's a very important piece of consciousness for us. So the question is, what causes that? How does that happen?
Something has triggered our vulnerability, triggered the vulnerability for one or the other of us or both of us, and we haven't known about it. We've been unconscious. We've disowned our vulnerability. We haven't known that something is bothering us. So that could be a number of things. You know, I could get frightened about something. I could get worried. We could get worried about money or some performance or some show that we have to be on. We could be hungry and not paying attention to that. We could be tired and not paying attention to that. We could be lonely. And we've been in our own offices and working too long and haven't paid attention to each other, and we could have gotten lonely. There are a lot of things that can happen. But what it is that the vulnerable child has in some way been triggered and we've ignored it. We haven't brought it into the interaction between us.
You know what popped into my mind just now? And that is when we take long trips in the car and you're driving and you get tired and hungry.
Oh, that's a great one.
And suddenly you begin to drive erratically and I begin to feel vulnerable. If I don't step in and become aware of the fact that I'm feeling vulnerable at those times and say something to you, what happens is I go into a very irritable father and I start to criticize your driving and I start to hack away at you.
Right, and then I get rebellious. I grab that wheel for dear life and
right.
I'm going to keep driving no
and
matter
you'll
what.
And drive faster and more erratically.
And more erratically and frighten you more and then you get more judgmental. But you know, it's interesting because we were in a positive bonding pattern before that. If I wasn't in good mother or macho mother or something like that, if I weren't doing that, I would be in touch with the fact that I'm getting tired and
right.
hungry, and I'd
right.
say, hey, Hal, I think you better take over for a while. Instead, my primary self of macho lady takes over, or good mother who wants you to rest, and I keep driving.
Right. I used to do that as a responsible father. Mm-hmm. Remember, I would drive the car excessively long beyond the time that was wise because I was tired, but I couldn't tune into that tiredness and vulnerability, and then we would lock into a kind of father-daughter place.
Mm-hmm. And then I, too, would be getting nervous judgmental and angry with you.
Right, right. So it's a lovely example of how that works. So the trigger, then, for these bonding patterns is vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. And vulnerability that we're just not in touch with and we don't deal with from an aware ego, but have the primary self come in and take over.
So either we don't know about the vulnerability, or in some instances there are people who know about vulnerability, but they don't know how to communicate vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a common thing also. Or they're ashamed of it, right.
Because I get ashamed if I'm tired or hungry and I can't drive whatever number of miles I thought I wanted to drive.
Or somebody feels frightened and they're afraid to say that they're frightened.
Because it seems foolish.
So the rational mind is a very big factor here in these considerations because the rational mind doesn't like the part of us that is frightened and vulnerable and
has
fearful
needs.
Of things and needy. Exactly.
It has needs for rest and food and comfort and friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think of the example between us that used to come up a lot, doesn't happen much anymore, where you'll be very, very busy and I start to feel very much abandoned. Mm-hmm. And my rational mind comes in and says, this is ridiculous. I mean, you know, at your age, you know.
you don't need her every minute.
You don't need her. You can live without her. This is ridiculous, you know. And absolutely will kill in me these, quote, foolish feelings, unquote. But this is the thing I think that's so important, and that is that the whole vulnerability axis consists of feelings that from the adult sides of our personality are very foolish.
That's absolutely true. And so we don't think of taking care of them directly. But what happens to a kid that's not being taken care of is it's going to get its needs met. So if the vulnerable child isn't taken care of by me, it's going to hook on to you and try to get you to take care of its needs.
Right, exactly.
In some indirect way. And it's probably going to get a bad daddy rather than it may get a good one for a while, but it's probably going to get a bad one sooner or later.
Right. And then we get into the question of once this trigger takes place and the bonding pattern ignites into the negativity, what is it that keeps that negativity going? What is the fuel that keeps burning that allows these psychic conflagrations between people to go on for very long periods of time?
And of course, that fuel is these disowned selves that we've been talking about. It's the disowned selves that we carry for each other. So if we go back to, I fell in love with Hal, at least in part because he was a visionary and he was magical and he was mystical and he wasn't a rational sort of person, then all of a sudden, this disowned self that he's carrying for me becomes something I can't stand. It frightens me. I get angry at it. I push off from it and I judge him for it.
Because now we're married and we have heavy monthly payments and she listens to me talking about new plans that I have and a new vision that I have.
And it's my money I get worried about.
Yeah, and she doesn't hear me talking about increasing my practice, or she doesn't hear me talking about giving priority to the meeting of our financial needs, so her vulnerability is hit. And as her vulnerability is hit, if she doesn't catch hold of the vulnerability, she is going to be going into a very judgmental mother, which she will either express out loud or she will express it energetically, which can be much worse.
Give him one of those cold, judgmental mother looks that men so love to get.
And I then am going to feel very badly about that, and if I don't catch hold of that, I'm going to shift into a very judgmental father, and I then will begin to judge Sidra as being too constricted, too tight. The very responsibility that I used to love and that meant so much to me and that made me feel so secure, suddenly I see as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once this judgmental process begins to take place in a relationship, love goes out the window. Love cannot survive these negative bonding patterns.
And the other thing that happens is we feel incredibly betrayed. because our vulnerable child has been betrayed. You know, this is the Hal that loved me for my responsibility and for the fact that I was a real sensible lady and watched out over money. And conversely, you know, I was the Sidra that loved his visionary nature and the fact that he had all these wonderful, magical, expansive plans and could break form. Mm-hmm.
That's very important, this betrayal idea, because it's so true, you know, that experience of the child and betrayal is so powerful, and this loved one becomes your most hated enemy.
And just the things that were kind of fascinating and dear and lovely are now the ammunition that I'm judging you for and you're judging me for.
Yeah, and here's the paradox of these bonding patterns when they turn sour. Here I am criticizing Sidra because she's too responsible and too tight. So my disowned self that she is carrying as a primary self becomes the club that I use in my hand to beat her up with.
Or at least in the hand of your judgmental father.
Yeah, in the hand of my judgmental father.
And then conversely, my judgmental mother wields the club of my disowned self, which is my visionary form-breaking self.
Right. Now, if we know something about primary and disowned selves, then we recognize our basic law of the psyche, which is those things that we criticize and attack and judge are our disowned selves. If I am able to step back and say, wait a minute, Hal, why is it that you are attacking Sidra and judging Sidra so violently for her responsible behavior, for her adherence to form, for her desire to have a balanced budget? Why is it that you are attacking her so strongly on this and that you judge her so violently? If I can step back and ask that question, then automatically our negative bonding pattern has given me the awareness of a disowned self. I no longer have to club you with it. I can step back and say, this is my medicine. This is the medicine that I need to heal myself. I don't mean to say that these things get solved in 24 hours. I don't
right.
want to give that impression. But nevertheless, once we take that step, it's a very, very big step. And conversely,
I can step back and realize that I've totally lost any attachment or any knowledge of my inner visionary or the part of me that can break form and take chances. And that Hal is my teacher, that I've disowned all of my ability to move freely in the world and to flow with what's happening. Then the other step, after we realize that we're carrying each other's disowned selves and that we are essentially teachers for one another in this, is to step back and look at what got us frightened in the first place. You know, what was it that triggered the vulnerability? And then speak to that issue directly. That's when we move back to an aware ego and we can share through an aware ego what the real issue is. And there I might say, hey, you know, I'm not judging you. I'm just really, really scared. From the way I look at things, if we go ahead with this plan, we're going to be running shortfalls of so many $1,000s a month for the next year. And I'm just worried about your health, my health, and our financial health.
Now, we're talking now about an entirely different kind of communication process. A communication process conducted by an aware ego that is in touch with both power and vulnerability. That's what we're trying to learn how to do. So when Sidra says to me that she's really feeling scared about the money and she's worried about her health and my health and so forth, I have got to be constellated very differently. I then, being aware of my own vulnerability, I say to Sidra, you know, I know that the money thing is important and I know that you have strong feelings about it, but you know, I just feel like the magic is being lost in our relationship, and I miss it. I miss that feeling of adventure, and isn't there some way we could be practical about money and still take some risks or have that feeling of magic? That's a very different kind of communication, and that's a kind of communication that's going to constellate her very differently. That communication incorporates the strength of my own position, the strength of my primary selves, my desire to support my primary selves, but it also incorporates my vulnerability. So long as we are able to communicate and embrace our vulnerability, it is almost impossible for the person on the other side to become polarized.
Because you could just feel the difference in those communications from the judgmental beating of each other that we would have been doing without that.
So maybe now the best thing to do would be to take some other examples because...
And just give people a feel of what that's like.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a man and a woman, John and Mary, who've gotten married. And Mary's a very personal, loving kind of lady, and John is more impersonal about... He doesn't need people quite so much, and he's more self-contained. And this was something that was very attractive to them about one another because they really were completing one another along this axis. But things have gone along, and say he has some trouble at work. He gets news that he is going to be responsible for laying off 15 of the men underneath him. And he's feeling very vulnerable and very, very bad about that. But he buries his vulnerability. As Hal was saying, he goes into this more rational side and said, hey, you know, that's part of the job. You know you're supposed to be able to do that. Any good manager has to be able to do that and keep moving. You can't fall apart and become a wimp. So he comes home. He doesn't know that he's vulnerable. He doesn't know he's been upset by this happening at work. And as he walks in the door, he sees his wife, Mary, is on the telephone, and she's chatting very animatedly with a friend. And she kind of waves to him like she usually does when he comes in and goes on talking. Doesn't drop things, doesn't respond to him at all, but is, you know, wound up with her girlfriend. He doesn't know that this hurts him because, after all, she's allowed to stay on the phone and he's a perfectly self-sufficient grown-up man. So he goes over and pours himself a drink, and by the time she hangs up on the phone, he's absolutely furious with her.
It's amazing.
We've got a bonding pattern happening.
It's amazing the things that can hurt the child's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and as we, you know, in our own relationship and in clinical practice, I mean... The vulnerable child can be hurt and frightened, it seems, by anything in the world, the sensitivity. It's a part of us that has no skin.
That's right. And it just reacts to everything. And things that we as grown-ups aren't supposed to react to, the child reacts to. So he's really embarrassed to cop to the fact that he felt left out and he needed her. Didn't make any signal to her to hang up or pay attention to him. But by the time she hangs up, he's in full rage, full bonding, full negative father, hollering at her for being over-involved with other people, always talking to her friends, playing therapist to the whole neighborhood, and he's off and running.
One thing that's really important here is to realize that bonding patterns are not just psychological events or emotional events between people. They are also energetic events between people. Now, it's hard to explain energy if somebody hasn't had a direct experience of energy. But I'll try to do it. Personal energy in a person means that they literally are expressing energy towards other people. You often feel it as a kind of a warmth, a natural warmth that's coming from
warmth,
the other people.
It's a give and take. You could just feel that the other person is with you.
Right.
And there's a sort of a melting between you almost.
Right, like a blending or melting. Impersonal energy is a condition in which the energy is withdrawn more from the other person. So there's a kind of a more of a vacuum between people when you're using impersonal energy.
It's cooler between two people, and you yourself, if you're in an impersonal state, feel cooler and clearer.
Like a man goes into impersonal energy.
Oh, my goodness, then the woman is absolutely abandoned. He's actually taking his energy back.
Right.
For instance, in this example, he would have gone totally into impersonal energy and... She would have felt left.
Yeah, and she doesn't know what she's reacting to. She may know the psychological side, but she doesn't realize that on an energetic level, he has pulled back literally this ordinary warm feel that he has with her.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are reacting to this without ever knowing, you know, what it's about. The other thing I wanted to say, too, that we meet so often is the idea that a lot of people are raised in families where one or two parents have behaved in a very impersonal way. And that there are really two kinds of impersonal energy. One kind is really related to people.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it's a sort of an ability to set boundaries around yourself and to be separate but there with a person.
Exactly, exactly.
There's something that a person can get from you.
Yeah, I've used the analogy a lot that impersonal energy is like having a telephone answering machine. If you're always in personal energy, you are required to be with everyone. You're required to meet everyone. You're required to answer every call that comes in. Impersonal energy gives you the ability to step back and, as you say, set boundaries. In some families, you have where vulnerability is extremely buried.
Then you really have this very withdrawn defended father
and there
or
it's
mother.
Cold
and there it's
and
cold
harsh.
And harsh, and you feel totally alone and abandoned.
Right.
And it's very, very uncomfortable. And lots of times, if you've had a parent like that, you don't want to be that way.
Right, right.
You sort of make a vow to yourself, well, I'm never going to be cold to people like my mother or father was. I'm going to be right. warm. I'm going to be available. I'm going to be loving.
Unfortunately, a lot of people who've had that experience of a parent throw out the baby with the bathwater because their experience of the impersonal was of this withdrawn, cold kind.
Mm-hmm. As opposed just to somebody who can set boundaries and
right.
be separated.
Yeah, so they throw out the whole thing.
Right.
Now, you find in many women also, we've seen this very often in clinical practice, that they are able to use impersonal energy in their business
yeah.
world.
Yeah. For instance, a teacher, a woman who's a teacher, certainly knows how to use it in the classroom where the children will run all over her.
Right.
Or as a therapist, she can be totally impersonal and clear
right.
with very well-defined boundaries in her office. And as soon as she steps out the door and her daughter comes and gives her a hug or her husband has something to say to her, she's mush, and she's totally personal. Can't carry it over. With women, lots of times, there's almost a feeling that it's unfair. It's unfeminine. It's unfair. It's not nice to be impersonal with people whom you love or you're very close to.
Right. Well, it is a very deep and profound training for women
mm-hmm.
to not be impersonal. We hear this all the time, and even with the new psychology in many women that has evolved through the women's movement, it seems as though the change that we have observed is in the business world, the professional world.
Where the women are able to be totally
impersonal.
They can be totally clear. Their boundaries are marvelously defined. They don't fall apart in the
right.
business setting.
But they get
walk
home
out the door and it's
in the primary relationship or with children,
mm-hmm.
and that personal comes back, and there they're not allowed to have it.
Right. And that's why lots of times, you know, we hear women say, I just don't understand it. I'm fine in the office, and I fall apart in my primary relationships.
Right. So why don't we go back now to John and Mary and see what that would look like if John really were connected to his vulnerability. It would be a very different story, wouldn't it?
It would be a very
it?
Different story. He'd come in and he'd say, he'd make some kind of sign to her to hang up that he needs her. And then he'd really let her know, hey, you know, I had this terrible news at the office. I'm going to have to lay off 15 men. I feel awful about it. I know I have to be brave and strong and be a role model and that it's part of the job, but gee, I wish I didn't have to do it and I feel
yeah.
awful. I need you tonight. I need
yeah.
you to pay attention.
He would have to say, I need you. And for the man identified with power to say to the other person, I need you, I'm feeling frightened, I'm feeling whatever it is, that is very, very difficult because that rational critical voice in us really is not very, very thrilled with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to bring in that vulnerability would totally change the communication process
mm-hmm.
between them. There's no way she could polarize. She may not drop the phone the second he asks.
But she certainly
would be related
and there would be that energetic flow between the two of them that you were talking about. Even if she were on the phone, there would be some flow between the two of them.
Let me ask you something that just occurred to me. In clinical practice, you meet a lot of people who are very much identified with their vulnerability.
Right.
Okay, we've been talking about the power side, okay? But a lot of people will say, I'm always victim and I'm
mm-hmm.
always vulnerable and so forth and so on. Could you say something about that and what it is that we're trying to do in terms of handling vulnerability?
Well, part of it is really learning ways to pay attention to our vulnerable child, to feel into it, to see what its needs are, and then to take care of them in a sort of a reasonable, centered way. Not to give in to them all the time, but to take care of them. And certainly developing a good impersonal is one of those. A woman or a man who's totally identified with being feeling all the time and being personal and being related to people is missing a very, very important part of life, and that's the ability to be impersonal when the situation calls for it, to set boundaries and to figure out what it is I need as opposed to what you need. So that's one very important thing, is to develop this ability to be impersonal. The other is to look around and see the people that we're drawing in over and over again in terms of disowned selves, and see what are some of the qualities that need developing. Some people study martial arts, Aikido, to learn how to use energies or one of the other martial arts, so you get a feeling of being able to literally protect one's own boundaries. People take workshops, learn how to communicate with the vulnerable child, learn how to be a parent to the inner child rather than a parent to the whole world. That's another way of taking care and of developing some protection for the personal, for the vulnerable.
Right. This brings up really an extremely important idea in relationship to the vulnerable child, and that is that it becomes the job of the aware ego to learn how to be a proper parent to that child. That the primary self has essentially raised the child. It's raised the person. It's a parent to the person for years and years and years and years.
We have to thank it, give it a kiss, retire it, and its aware ego's take over.
And just like a real parent, the aware ego has to learn how to become a parent to the primary self, and it has to learn how to be a parent to the vulnerable child. The only way that the primary self knows how to take care of that child is to bury it.
Right.
That's how you keep it safe.
Right, or to put it on the front line, you know, for people who have been victim and feeling all the time, to put that vulnerable child out in front to make the contact when you need something else, when the child's going to get mashed to pieces.
Mm-hmm. So this parenting concept is very central to our thinking about relationship and the development of personality, because if I can become a parent to my child and really nurture it, that means that you don't have to have 100% responsibility for taking care of
it. And you won't be mad at me if I don't take perfect care of it.
Exactly. The consequence of a child who isn't cared for by an aware ego is that that child is going to be dependent on you and other adults, but primarily you, and is going to be hurt unbelievably if you blink the wrong way on Sunday morning. I mean, it's going to be terribly hurt.
Absolutely true.
Unless I'm in touch with it and I'm feeding it what it needs. So if I'm overworking and I'm, you know, taking on much too much and I don't give my child what it needs, then at some level it's going to look to you for its nurturance.
That's right. And if I don't take care of mine, if I don't know when to stop, if I don't know when to go to sleep, if I don't know when to eat, if I don't know when I need some more structuring or less structuring, then my child is going to expect you to take care of her and do all the right things. So it's real interesting, because what happens is that I have to integrate the parts of you that know how to do it.
Right.
The disowned selves that you're carrying for me.
Right.
So you're always teaching me.
And needless to say, vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do a summary and give our listeners a chance to put these ideas together, okay?
Okay, the basic bonding patterns are between the adult parts of us and the child parts of another person, and the child parts of us and the adult parts of another person, so that my child would be bonded into the good or bad fathers in hell, and my mother, either good or bad, would be bonded into the child side in hell. That's the form of the bonding pattern. The trigger of the bonding pattern is the vulnerability. Something happens to disrupt my vulnerability. I'm not in touch with it. I disown it. I don't take care of my child in a direct way. Don't present her needs through an aware ego to Hal. And instead fall into the bonding pattern, a negative bonding pattern. So that's the trigger.
The fuel, then, that maintains the fire, the club that people use to bash each other's head in.
With great effectiveness.
With great effectiveness. That belongs to the disowned selves of the two people. So that whatever it is that John disowns, if he disowns his personal side, the part that's related to people and enjoys being with them and talking to them, that is what he will criticize Mary about. He will criticize her for being too personal, for always being involved, and he will beat her up with the very medicine that he needs for himself. Mary, who is identified with the personal side as a primary self system, is going to criticize John for being too cold, too withdrawn, not caring about people, not being involved with people, for being a rotten father, and whatever else she can lay her hands on, because once these bonding patterns trigger into their negative form, if the disowned selves are very strong, the clubs that people use to beat each other up with are also equally strong.
And we find that these patterns themselves are repeating patterns that have existed earlier in life. So each time we get into a bonding pattern, we're beating the person up with a disowned self. It's a replication of somebody we've beaten up in the past, because our disowned selves remain disowned until we claim them. And we're constantly drawing people in to replay. So that's why we so often hear, well, they marry the same person over and over and over again, or you get into the same relationship over and over again, until you step out, realize that the other person is your teacher, that there is the possibility of using the relationship as one means of moving in towards consciousness. And that consciousness itself, as far as we are concerned, is the awareness of is the combination of the awareness and the experience of what's happening, and the ability to make choices, to feel into the totality of the situation, and to move forward in a choiceful way, in touch with the basic fingerprint, the psychic fingerprint within.
The other thing we would just add here to the summary is that the current concept of codependency is another way, really, of expressing the idea of bonding patterns. For us, however, bonding patterns are simply, as we have described, a natural unit of psychic interaction, and we do not see them as pathological. The danger in talking about codependency is that it can become a kind of diagnostic system that is judged. There is nothing wrong with codependency.
It's one of the forms of bonding.
It's one of the forms of bonding pattern, mm-hmm. and the trick is to become aware of it and to experience the different parts that involve you in codependency, to separate from those parts. There is no way to eliminate codependency. It is an animal that is here forever because it simply is one form of bonding pattern. What all of this does, as we separate from these different selves and become aware of them, all of this leads gradually to the evolution of the aware ego. It is this aware ego, as we said before, that automatically allows us to experience the essence level of our personality, and that essence level then has a chance to meet the essence level of the other person. This is not some kind of final, ultimate state that we reach. This is a process always going on. It will be interspersed constantly with the bonding patterns, positive and negative, but gradually over time, there will emerge more and more of an aware ego and more of this essential being in each of us that meets the other person.